This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. The Prime Minister Scott Morrison's asked the National Cabinet to start holding two meetings a week in an effort to get the nation's troubled vaccine rollout back on track. The National Cabinet, which is made up of the Prime Minister, state and territory leaders, was formed at the start of the pandemic to tackle the unique problems it presented. Recently, it's been meeting monthly, but federal government sources say they now want to return to a war footing. From Canberra, James Glendate filed this report.
Well, I've already answered the first question on several occasions, so I don't propose to do that again.
For the past 5 days, Scott Morrison and his ministers have been repeatedly asked exactly when all adult Australians should expect to be vaccinated against COVID-19.
But I don't think anyone should expect that anytime soon.
Last week's announcement that the AstraZeneca jab is no longer recommended for people under the age of 50 due to the small risk of blood clots has thrown the nation's vaccine rollout into turmoil. And with a population already fatigued by missed or abandoned targets, the federal government is hoping to swiftly restore public faith in its plans. The Prime Minister wants to do that by returning to a so-called war footing with the help of premiers. In a statement, he announced,
National Cabinet will convene on Monday, April the 19th, and will meet bi-weekly for the foreseeable future until we solve the problems and get the program back on track.
Twice-weekly meetings might not just boost cooperation, but also help diffuse some of the tensions between the states and the Commonwealth. Recently, ministers have been engaged in slanging matches over who is to blame for delays in getting jabs into arms. And the New South Wales Health Minister, Brad Hazzard, recently claimed he was finding out new information about the rollout from the ABC.
As Health Minister here in New South Wales, I'm extremely angry. And I know there are other health ministers in the country who share similar views.
But the biggest problem the vaccine program has been facing is supply. This week, Trade Minister Dan Tehan is heading to Europe, where he'll discuss the decision by the EU to stop the export of some vaccine vials to Australia.
I think it'll be very difficult to force countries to do anything. But what I think we can do is encourage countries to really focus on increasing production so that contracts can be honoured. And that's what I'll be seeking to do.
There are warnings, though, that Australia should be prepared for the possibility of more disruption over the next year. Rasmus Beck-Hansen from British company Airfinity, which advises nations on their vaccine portfolios, says it's going to be very difficult to get jabs out of Europe in the short term, and America is likely Australia's best option.
I think Australia has a fairly strong portfolio of vaccines, so I don't think Australia is in that bad position. I think because the infections have been so low in Australia, the urgency to get vaccinations out has been less, and we're seeing that in many other countries. So there seems to be this, ironically, that it's almost like the worse a country is performing on infections and mortality, the better it is performing on vaccination rollout.
Rasmus Beck-Hansen from the British company Airfinity, ending James Glendale's report. A day after Australia declared it wouldn't be buying any of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine, the US has stopped using it while it investigates links with a small number of blood clot cases. Nearly 7 million Americans have received the single-dose vaccine so far, but the clots developed by half a dozen women have prompted health authorities to press pause on any more. Here's North America correspondent Greg Jennett.
To enhance Johnson & Johnson's production capacity,
billed as one dose and done, the Johnson & Johnson vaccines never quite hit the potential that its makers, Janssen, J&J, and pharma giant Merck, had hoped for.
Johnson & Johnson and Merck will not rest until it is won.
Production at a plant in Baltimore was bedeviled by cross-contamination with AstraZeneca's rival product. Now, the two have something else in common.
Out of an abundance of caution, we're recommending a pause in the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine.
Janet Woodcock runs the Food and Drug Administration, the regulator of medicines. They imposed the recommended halt on further J&J shots after six women, aged between 18 and 48, developed brain blood clots within 9 to 13 days of their vaccination. One of the women later died. Those six cases come from almost 7 million doses administered so far. Presidential advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci.
This is a really rare event. There have been six out of the 6.85 million doses, which is less than one in a million.
Authorities aren't saying conclusively that the vaccine caused the clots, but Peter Marks of the FDA is upfront about the likelihood, especially considering AstraZeneca's experience with the same phenomenon.
It's plainly obvious to us already that what we're seeing with the Janssen vaccines looks very similar to what was being seen with the AstraZeneca vaccine. Obviously, they are from the same general class of viral vectors.
Big federal mass vaccination centres will heed the pause. So will many run by the states. For how long? Dr. Fauci's uncertain.
It's going to be more like days to weeks rather than weeks to months.
Whatever the risks, the timing's terrible for Johnson & Johnson because it was hoping to ramp up production soon, closing the wide gap on the Pfizer and Moderna shots. White House vaccine boss Jeff Zients says those two will now become the default, and there's more than enough to go round.
You know, we really have thought of this as a wartime effort from the beginning, which is why we purchased excess supply.
Even so, what's called a red flag event around the J&J shot will hardly help those hesitant to take one, which is why Joe Biden's instilling confidence whenever he can.
I made sure we have 600 million doses. So there's enough vaccine that is basically 100% unquestionable for every single solitary American.
In Washington, this is Greg Jennett reporting for AM.
The Brits are surging ahead with their vaccine rollout. Everyone over 50 has been offered at least one dose, and now people in their 40s are being urged to line up for the needle. But despite the success, the British leader Boris Johnson is cautious, saying a drop in infections is more to do with the lockdown. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
My first vaccine order.
Thank you. Oh, I didn't feel anything.
The UK is surging ahead and is on track to meet its target to offer all adults their first dose of a vaccine by the end of July. 32 million people across the UK have now had one dose. More than 7 million have been fully inoculated.
So I was originally booked in for the Oxford vaccine last week, but that was cancelled and rearranged given the new guidance on blood clots.
People under 30, like this woman, are now being given the Moderna vaccine.
It's been really efficient in reorganising it so quickly, and I think it reassures people that there are alternatives if they're worried.
Boris Johnson is cautious, saying the vaccine success is not the reason for the drop in the infection rate.
Yes, of course, the vaccination programme has helped, but the bulk of the work in reducing the disease has been done by the lockdown. So, as we unlock, the result will inevitably be that we will see more infection. We will see more hospitalisation and deaths.
England began reopening this week with outdoor dining at pubs and restaurants now allowed and retail outlets operating again. And the British leader hopes the current roadmap, which will see all restrictions lifted by mid-June, will eventuate, but he can't guarantee it.
It is very, very important that if we're to get there in the way that we all want, that people continue to be cautious.
The vaccine take-up so far is at around 95%, leaving some people vulnerable. Public health expert Gabrielle Scally says a third wave of cases is highly likely.
Because a high proportion of elderly and at-risk people have been vaccinated, the death toll probably won't be as high, but there will still be deaths and there will still be disability. So it really is a significant worry. And the government is trying to intervene in areas where they are worried.
In London, there is concern over the spread of the South African variant of the disease, with more than 70 potential cases now detected in two suburbs. The variant is less resistant to the vaccines, and 6 of 10 nursing home residents who tested positive had one jab. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
Australia's vaccine plan has hit fresh roadblocks with a second case of rare blood clotting potentially linked to the AstraZeneca jab. And Novavax, which the federal government had hoped to get hold of by the middle of the year, has pushed back its global production targets to later this year. With the vaccine rollout disrupted, doctors say they're having to spend a lot more time with each patient to reassure them about safety. And that's having an impact on their bottom line, with GPs complaining they're not being reimbursed adequately for the process. Nick Grimm reports.
Dr. Chimera Ranatunga has just finished a vaccine clinic at his medical practice at Werribee in Melbourne's southwest.
So we have had about 50 patients come through today, and there was quite a lot of questions around the vaccine. We are hearing more and more.
Reports of rare but serious blood clots linked to the AstraZeneca vaccine and the decision by Australian health officials to suggest under 50s avoid it has many of Dr. Ranatunga's patients worried about whether it's a safe option for them.
And we know that the clot risk with this AstraZeneca vaccine is an extremely, extremely small population that can be affected.
Have you had any patients who've turned around and refused a vaccine after speaking to you and ventilating those concerns?
So there has been about, out of maybe the 250 vaccines that we have offered and the consults that we have had, possibly around three or four people who have decided to wait.
People are a bit more reluctant to get it, and that even includes, sadly, some healthcare workers.
Last week, online bookings were fully subscribed at Dr. Umber Rin's medical practice in Melbourne's north. In the last few days, the GP has seen numbers drop, but those keeping their appointments have a lot of questions.
There is a lot more time spent with the patient. You have to explain the procedure, the consent. You know, there's a lot of information to discuss. And obviously then people have a lot of questions. So that sometimes is not something you can do in a couple of minutes, and you need up to 15, 20 minutes to maybe address certain fears in those who are vaccine hesitant.
And that's a problem, these doctors say, because they're losing income in the process.
At the moment, we aren't being reimbursed even for a standard consult. We're being reimbursed much less. So there's definitely been a lot of chatter amongst GPs in private little discussions that they're not quite happy with the rebates that we're getting.
Nurse practitioners too are unimpressed. They're also not being encouraged to help speed up the vaccine rollout. Under federal funding arrangements, they're blocked from accessing the medical benefit scheme item numbers that would allow them to administer the shots. Leanne Bowes is president of the Australian College of Nurse Practitioners.
Yeah, well, it's really a bit of a no-brainer. I mean, we've got GPs that are flat out and, you know, they're saying they're not really getting remunerated well enough for doing it. They're getting inundated with inquiries. If we engage the nurse practitioner workforce to assist, I think it could only be a win-win. It's really a missed opportunity.
And that's Leanne Bowes, and she's the president of the Australian College of Nurse Practitioners. Now, reporter Nick Grimm. As the huge clean-up continues in Western Australia's midwest in the wake of Cyclone Seroja, there are concerns about how long the rebuild could take. The WA construction industry is already experiencing a significant backlog, with materials and labour already stretched. There are predictions it might take 2 years before reconstruction of the region is complete. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Driving between his farm properties in and around the town of Mullawar, Rod Messina was shocked at the extent of the damage from the cyclone.
There wasn't one place I saw that didn't have any sort of damage at all. So, you know, I think yesterday they were talking, you know, a 70 or 80 kilometre wide band by 700 kilometres long. Well, you can just imagine anything in that path is going to have damage. So it's a huge area.
On his own properties, a roof has been ripped from a house. He's lost 13 sheds, fertiliser supplies, countless fences, windmills and water tanks. And while his insurer says he'll be covered for the losses, the timeline is less certain.
Basically, our insurance has said, you know, we'll be able to, no problems cash settling or giving you a list of preferred suppliers, but the chances of getting anything done or where you are on the list or, you know, that's going to be the biggest issue. Like, I just don't know where we're going to find the people to to fix the structural stuff.
The problem is that Western Australian builders are already experiencing significant delays in getting projects off the ground thanks to shortages of material and labour, with 70% of the buildings in Kalbarri either damaged or destroyed, significant damage in Northampton and surrounding rural communities. The construction industry will struggle to cope with the demand.
We are concerned about how that's all going to play out at a trade level.
John Jalavis is the Executive Director of Master Builders WA. He says while the COVID-19 pandemic has restricted supply of building materials, government stimulus like the Home Builder Package has fueled demand.
And that's caused some supply chain issues, particularly with some of the wet trades at the moment, concreters and bricklayers. And that's just one part of the story. What we've also seen is some of the global supply chain, the local supply chains of materials being impacted. And we've seen timber being one, particle board.
Which means it'll be some time before cyclone-affected communities will be back on their feet.
I think it would take around about 2 years to completely rebuild.
For Rod Messina, who's in the midst of planting canola, wheat and other crops, a slow rebuild is a delay he can't afford.
We can all build sheds and repair sheds as farmers. It's what we do, you know, if we have to do it. But like I say, our priority now is the 2021 crop, and we need to get that in the ground. And how we're going to do those extra things on the farm is really beyond me.
Mullawar farmer Rod Messina and our reporter Bridget Fitzgerald in Perth. The Assistant Defence Minister Andrew Hastie has told military personnel their core business will always be the application of lethal violence. The blunt message from the former Special Forces officer comes as some government figures question the appropriateness of a suggestive dance performance last weekend to formally commission the Navy's newest ship. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
HMAS Supply is the newest addition to the Royal Australian Navy. It was formally welcomed to the fleet at a commissioning ceremony on the weekend, which featured a group of local female dancers whose performance included twerking. Liberal MP and former soldier Philip Thompson says the risque dance display didn't meet ADF standards.
We've got the CDF, we've got members of parliament there, and you know the governor general's there. I don't think it's appropriate to be twerking. I think that our standard in the ADF and definitely commissioning a ship should be a little bit higher than that.
Philip Thompson is among a group of federal government MPs agitating for a cultural shift across the Defence Force. But it's not the direction you might think. These MPs want to push back against decisions regarded as too politically correct, such as the 2018 directive banning soldiers from wearing death symbols, including the Grim Reaper and the skull and crossbones.
Our ADF shouldn't be left or right. They should be straight down the middle of what their job is. And their job is to defend our nation, our interests, our values, our sovereignty, but also when we go on operations, have an unapologetic aggression and violence to get the mission done.
His sentiments have been echoed by the Assistant Defence Minister, Andrew Hastie. In a letter to his constituents, the former SAS officer writes, "Our military serves a vital role across Australian society, whether during pandemic, flood or fire, but the ADF's core business will always be the application of lethal violence in the defence of our values, sovereignty and interests. We should never forget that," Mr. Hastie argues. Senior Morrison government figures say the Assistant Minister's message closely aligns with the directives new Defence Minister Peter Dutton issued to the ADF's top brass during their initial meetings. Philip Thompson says he's pleased with the direction being set out by the ministers.
Having Minister Dutton at the helm and leading our Australian Defence Force, we're bringing back to our core values. And, you know, we've gone a little bit woke over the past few years and we can't afford to be doing that.
Neil James from the Australia Defence Association has welcomed Minister Hastie's comments on the ADF's core business, but rejects Philip Thompson's suggestion that it's become too politically correct.
The whole point about banning stupid cartoon symbols in the Defence Force is to restore professionalism as a warfighting organisation. It's not a case of political correctness. It's a case of getting rid of a stupid young fashion that detracts from the professionalism.
And that's Neil James from the Australia Defence Association, ending that report from Andrew Green. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. It started with a public row about Cartier watches, and now the former CEO of Australia Post, Christine Holgate, has hit back. Her targets include the Prime Minister Scott Morrison and several others. She says they bullied and humiliated her out of the job. Not only that, she says a man in her position would not have faced the same treatment.
Today on The Signal, we review the fireworks show from Parliament yesterday and find out what it was that lit the fuse. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.